As you know, Tom Woods is next up to speak as a Mises circle, and this is indeed almost a circle. You've almost got him encircled. But before that, we have a surprise for Tom. And to deliver that surprise is the guy who really made this all possible. In 1982, he founded the Mises Institute after being a member of Ron Paul's congressional chief of staff. He's a frequent guest on Andrew Napolitano's Freedom Watch. He's got a website you might have heard of, lewrockwell.com. Living libertarian legend, chairman, CEO, Mises Institute, Lew Rockwell.
Thank you very much. I want to talk to you for a moment tonight about a great man called George Cother. George was recognized as an extraordinary writer even in high school. He went to Albion College in Michigan, where also he was a successful writer. After leaving Albion, he went to work for the Saturday Evening Post. That's a magazine long gone, but in those days, a huge member of the top American media. Went to work for Look magazine. He was an early staff member of the Foundation for Economic Education. He decided he wanted to study economics. He went to NYU. We had the chance to take classes from Mises. He wrote just one book called The Ass That Went to Washington in the guise of a children's book, but it's a case for libertarianism. George was a very successful speechwriter, ghostwriter. He wrote for the CEOs of companies like Continental Can, Ford Motor Company, founded his own consulting firm where he did speeches. He helped, he didn't ghostwrite, but he was a big help in organizational questions to Margaret von Mises in doing My Years with Ludwig von Mises. To call him a great raconteur doesn't really do it. I mean, he really was the most charming, good-looking, well-spoken, well-mannered man you could ever meet. Full of the most extraordinary stories, most of which I cannot repeat here, but he was so funny. He was an extraordinary Austrian economist, although he never wrote in his own name about that. He was an historian and a very, very close friend of Margaret and Ludwig von Mises. He and his wife Ilo were frequent guests of the Miseses, and although there was a huge age difference, if you knew George, you would only have to meet him to know that you could understand why anybody loved to be around him. A dedicated libertarian, a strong supporter of the Institute. I had a chance to be involved with that book, The Ass That Went to Washington. And when I started the Institute, he was a strong supporter, always interested, would come to our programs, even in his 90s. He lived in Vero Beach, Florida. He'd hop in his car, his old Buick, and drive up here by himself. And charm everyone. And about 3 years before his death, he died at the age of 98 in 2006. I guess the only thing he ever didn't, the only goal he never succeeded in making, he wanted to be 100. And he only made it to 98 and a half. But he came up here at 96 and he wanted to talk about his will and the money he wanted to leave the Institute and what would be a good use for that money. And so he was very, very pleased that there would be an annual prize, the George M. Cother Prize, for the best free market book published the preceding year. Now, normally, when we have to make this designation, there's a lot of competition. Unlike in the early days of George Cother, we have lots of wonderful free market books being published now. So you have, you know, back and forth thing about which one there was going to be. But for last year, really, there was just no choice whatsoever. We knew it was Tom Woods' book, Meltdown. And Tom also, of course, has had a long affiliation with the Institute. He was a student at the Mises University as an undergraduate at Harvard. He was also a summer fellow here. And I might say that while the fact that he grew up and became a great teacher, the author of 11 books and counting, I'm sure it's going to be 111 before he's done, that he's become such a TV star, while that's been gratifying to everybody who knew him as an undergraduate, we're not really shocked. I mean, it was clear he was going to be a significant person. And one of my great memories from the Mises University at Claremont College, when he was an undergraduate, was seeing him go up to talk to Murray Rothbard at the barbecue, and they're talking away like this. And about 2 hours later, I go back by that same place, and they're still there. They're going like that. And in a sense, it was a prediction, because Murray Rothbard always dreamed, because he was an historian as well as an economist, he always dreamed of a professional historian who would actually know economics, unlike, of course, all of the rest of them. So here we have Tom Woods, and we're so glad that he's been a senior fellow here. He's leaving after the Mises University. He and Heather, his wife, and their children headed to Kansas, maybe in some sense replacing Doug French. We got Doug from Kansas originally, and so now Tom is going up there, but he's going to continue to be very much connected to the Institute. He's going to continue teaching our programs and, of course, write his great books. And Tom, it's a great honor and pleasure to give you this George M. Cother Medal. It's a very handsome medal in honor of you and Mr. Cother. And there's an annual, there's a stipend of $2,500.
Wow. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. I entrust these to you. Wow. So I'm just going to go right ahead. Wow. Well, that is really something. Wow. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. In fact, I think I'm going to take this out. No, I can't. Yeah, I know, but I was gonna walk around with it. No? Oh, it's taped in. That's okay. All right. So I'm doing this just for you people. You understand? Okay. I'm staying put just for you people because I do want to acknowledge, you know, all you people up there. You know, right? All the people in the cheap seats who never get acknowledged. You know, I want you to have a hello. Well, again, thank you very much to Lou and everybody. I mean, I've never been more honored in my life than to have had the chance to be associated with the Mises Institute and continue to be associated with it. Really, there's no place in the world really that makes me prouder really as a scholar or anything. I mean, just when I think of the people I'm associated with here, and you've gotten to get to know some of them at least intellectually so far, and I hope personally as the week goes on. That any kind of honor that comes from here, I mean, I couldn't ask for anything better. So thank you for that. Lou mentioned 11 books. Well, the 11th one isn't coming until next year. So we're sort of, we'll say 10 and a half. And it better be produced from my publisher's point of view because I've already spent the advance money. So it really has to come out. Now, there is a little more room here. Like, you know, you could, like, right up in front. You could sit underneath here. So, I mean, you know, feel free. While I'm talking, feel free to worm your way in. And you may be thinking to yourselves, I'm going to step away from the mic for a minute. You may be thinking to yourselves, why have they crammed us into this ridiculous space, right? It makes no sense. We've got this wonderful lecture hall. I bet Mr. Wolf is sitting here saying, look, I gave you people money so you wouldn't have to do this. And here we are. But this is my crazy request because in the old days, this was how it would always be done. The Mises Circle is sort of the informal thing at the end of the day. And so, you know, you sit cross-legged, whatever. But now that we're setting attendance records, it's harder and harder to mash people in. So if you're thinking, I can't believe it's 100 billion degrees in this town and everything else, and now I'm in here like a sardine, I can't believe. But just think about how fun this is. At some level, this is really like the greatest experience of the whole week. And it's so funny that people are such old pros at this, because there's Jeff Herbener in his traditional seat that he has every year. He gets here at like 5:15 and he just gets that seat. All right, well, just one other quick thing. I guess some of you know I went to Mises University because Lou mentioned it, and you may have heard before. 1993, that was. That's some time ago. And that, all right, I don't need the whistles. I did go to Mises University. By the way, I don't have my glasses on, so I don't actually know where Roderick Long is sitting. So I'm just relying on his laughter to indicate, though he is, in fact, here. Okay, all right, good. All right, anyway, that's always a good kind of sense of how I'm doing. But anyway, so I went to this thing in 1993, and Rothbard was indeed alive at that time. It was a very interesting experience. Wonderful to get to meet him and to also see the reaction of the students when he was introduced. I mean, just berserk. cheering and applauding and just standing ovation for the guy, and it was just great. And he gave the opening lecture, so he was the Guido Holzman of the 1993 event, and it was just wonderful, and the cackles and the laughter. And as I've told people, even his worst enemy never said he was arrogant. No one has ever accused him of that. You can say whatever you want to say about him. Well, and you shouldn't, because he was a good guy, but people do. But one thing they don't even try to say is that he was arrogant, because he would sit there, it's true, he'd talk to you forever and ever, and like, you're just some nobody jerk, and he's, you know, he's interested, he'll talk to you, and he'll share his own, like, I love Doug French's story about he's going to go study with Murray Rothbard for some of his master's work, and he wants to write a little something on the Great Depression. And Rothbard almost offhandedly says, well, you know, I wrote a little something on that. That's true. And then later on, Doug feels like a complete idiot. So, is he here anymore? Is Doug left? All right, I don't want to mention Doug and idiot in the same sentence. I do have one more week here at the Institute. All right, back to the microphone. All right, so you should enjoy yourself this week. You should be talking to these professors. You don't just listen to them. Talk to them. And you got only 1 week. So when you're sitting down for dinner with them, you don't have time to talk about how hot it is, whatever. Yeah, we all know it's hot. Talk to them about, you know, whatever, marginal utility or something. But talk to them, because you'll be amazed at how much they know, especially this Herbener guy who just thinks that if he's really super quiet and reserved, people won't realize what a genius he is. Well, you know, I already blew your cover. All right, well, I guess what I'm going to be doing tonight in this sort of briefish time is saying a little something about this new book that I have. And I'm going to say different things to you guys than I would say in my normal crowd. So let me grab it. Okay, so it's this book, Nullification. All right? All right, now I'll put it back down. Okay. And I did this in the middle of working on something else. I was working on another project, the 2011 book, and I suddenly noticed that people are talking about state nullification. I thought it was interesting that when this Real ID Act was passed in 2005 that involved identification procedures and maybe getting us on the road to a national ID card, there were people all over the spectrum philosophically who were opposed to this. And so you had about two dozen states basically saying, well, we're not going to actually comply with this. So, you know, go ahead, send in the tanks. We're just not doing it. And so it, you know, more or less died. And now they're trying to pass another law just sort of like it, but maybe it'll have the same sort of reception from the states. And I thought, well, isn't this quite interesting that this happened? Or the medical marijuana case that made it to the Supreme Court in 2005. Here's a Supreme Court saying you can't do this. You can't make an exception to the general drug prohibition for medical marijuana, even in a case like this in which the lawyers in the Ninth Circuit, the judges of the Ninth Circuit even freely conceded that this woman will die without this remedy, that no other medication helps her without intolerable side effects. She suffers from a mysterious wasting disorder that causes her to lose a pound of weight per day. So the court actually said that unfortunately, well, they didn't say unfortunately, they just said the Constitution does not recognize any freedom to use medical marijuana for the alleviation of excruciating pain and suffering. Well, that's just super. The beautiful thing about it, though, is that they make these statements, and yet people do it anyway. Now, you may say, but this is a small sliver. All right, it's a small sliver, but it's better than nothing. It's a small issue. But the point is that the government, the Justice Department's against this, the Supreme Court's against it, the Ninth Circuit's against it, and yet they're still doing it. And so, now, some people come back at me and say, well, that's not a very good example of nullification, because, which I will define in a second, but that's not a very good example because the Justice Department has decided not to crack down on these people anymore. So that's not a good example. And I'm sort of thinking, well, why do you think they decided not to crack down anymore? You think the Justice Department woke up one day and said, you know, we're just interpreting the Commerce Clause all wrong. We shouldn't be. No, it was because people weren't going along with it. And they don't want to look, bad, which is one of the key things. They do not want to be made to look bad. So they just decided to, in effect, ratify what was already going on, namely widespread civil disobedience by saying, well, we're not really going to give anybody a hard time about this. Well, thanks for being so magnanimous. But it shows that by just not doing it, well, you can sometimes bring about some sort of change. So, now this is particularly for those who are here from other countries. We've got people here from like 9,000, like more countries than there are on the earth somehow made it to this event, okay? And by the way, I'm not assuming you guys are from other countries, but I haven't acknowledged you in a while, so hello. But especially for people from other countries, nullification refers to this idea that an American state can, in fact, refuse to enforce a federal law, and in fact, obstruct the enforcement of a federal law that violates the U.S. Constitution. And what I show in the book is that there is actually reason to believe, just on constitutional grounds, there is reason to believe that such a power exists, and I talk about the ratifying convention in Virginia, and if you actually read the documents of the ratifying convention of Virginia, there's a very strong presumption that people are going into this under the belief that they can, in fact, nullify any attempt by the federal government to reach for what they called any supplementary condition. So any power that wasn't expressly delegated to it, if they try to reach for another power, well, Virginia will be exonerated from it. And yet even on those grounds, even then, Virginia still only barely ratified the Constitution. And then also it's been used for honorable purposes throughout American history. Now, it's also been referred to on behalf of dishonorable purposes, and I'll talk about that in a little while because that needs to be addressed. Okay, now having said that, now I talk to you people who want to say, well, Constitution, smonstitution, right? This you know, who cares about this stupid thing, right? It's a crummy document that allows for taxation and all these other things, and you know, and to heck with it. And I was gonna maybe even say a bad word there, but here's my wife sitting right here, so I'm on my really super good behavior. And also for you people, I don't even know who's in that room. So I want to be careful. I'm super super, super duper courteous and everything. But anyway, so you want to know, like, well, so who cares, right? All right. To an extent, I agree with you. I mean, of course, you're right about that. But one thing I enjoy doing is I enjoy solving puzzles. I enjoy beating people at their own game. And so my view is that, well, if you're going to play by this Constitution game, I can beat you there, too. Like, if you want to talk about, hey, well, the Constitution, blah, 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 I can say, well, pfft, well, what about this? And then, you know, well, wait a minute. They're kind of stymied a little bit. So I like to meet people on their own ground and show that even though I think I can make a good philosophical argument probably against the whole Constitution, I don't even need to do that. I can also beat you constitutionally and historically. It's just fun for me. I mean, I get a lot of excitement out of this. So that is sort of the motivation. But also, think about, there is a radical potential here. I mean, for those of us in this room, this seems too little too late. It's not nearly radical enough. I agree. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are willing to consider this idea now. And this is about as far as they're ready to go. So I want to meet them there, because this is much farther than most people have been willing to go in an incredibly long time. Like, people, there are unthinkable, previously unthinkable ideas on the table now that were not on the table before. That you can talk about this, and I've been on fairly mainstream radio talking about this, and people are talking about it like it's a regular issue. That, yeah, okay, this guy wants to nullify laws. Okay, you know, what's the next? You know, when are we going to have the monkey trainer come on? Is he the next guest? I mean, just like I'm a regular guy. I'm like a regular guy. It's incredible to me that this has been possible. So I want to cultivate this. That's why I started to write this while working on something else. I postponed the other thing, and I said, no, time seems to be right for this thing, so let's nab it. So it encourages among people, a lot of people who are angry and frustrated by the fact that no matter what they do, the federal government just grows. Like, they can't stop it. Like, they've done everything. They hold conferences talking about how terrible it is. They vote for some boob who promises to fix it, and he never does. He becomes, you know, and they still get all these stab marks in their back from all the betrayals of people. And they just don't know what the heck to do. And meanwhile, they got these, you know, like Newt Gingrich coming around to them saying, hey, here's my new pack or whatever. Just send me some dough and we'll fix this problem. And some people are just saying, you know, come on. Come on. We've just been through this a million times. Now, I should point out in parentheses, by the way, that obviously being interested in Austrian economics does not commit you to a particular position on nullification one way or another. Okay, so this is, again, outside the bounds of the full Mises program. So, you know, don't feel like, if you're not in favor of nullification, you're expelled from society here. It's just, it's not a strictly Austrian question, but that's why we do it after dinner. Okay, after dinner is when we get to all this stuff. But the other thing is that it cultivates the idea of resistance. Now, again, maybe not as much resistance as there should be, but, you know, well, one step at a time, right? Get people in the habit of saying, wait a minute, are they allowed to do that? Can they do that? And you never know where that type of thinking can lead, so might as well get them thinking that way. Ultimately, really what nullification is in our day is a kind of civil disobedience with a twist. The twist being that this is civil disobedience that's sanctioned by a state, that the state is in effect pledging to protect people from the consequences of their disobedience. And if they're not prepared to do that, then they're not being serious about nullification. But that's ultimately what it requires, is the willingness of state officials to in fact protect people from the federal government if it should come to that. So that's it. And so to me, this is a good thing. And let's also point out another reason I think this is a useful libertarian strategy is that you might think, well, gee, but maybe the states will nullify things that and thereby exercise more power over their people. But by and large, you don't need to nullify to be more oppressive than the federal government, by which I mean any state is free to have a higher minimum wage than the federal government imposes. They can do that. They can have higher regulations on various things than the federal government imposes. The problem is they can't have lower ones. So nullification ultimately amounts to just saying, no, we don't want you to do this or this or this or this. Now, still, it is important to point out, you know, what would people say, though? What would you say if somebody said, but, you know, states have in fact used this sort of power or tried to for purposes that are completely disreputable and dishonorable and wicked. How do you answer that? Well, part of the answer is, well, duh. I mean, they're states, right? You have to expect they're going to be, you know, staffed by sociopaths. So, of course, they're going to do terrible things. But the question is, what about right this minute in 2010? Because it is not fair to freeze, in the same way that the neoconservatives freeze the whole world in Munich 1938. Like, it's always Munich 1938 for them. But likewise, for some on the left, it's always Birmingham 1963. And that's not fair either. Because, as you know, a lot of us, those of us who've lived in Alabama, we know there are perfectly decent, good people here. And there are some jerks here, but there are a lot of jerks in New York, too. I can testify to this, okay? And the fact is that over the past 25 to 30 years, if you look at the demographic trends, where have blacks been moving? What section of the country have they been moving to? To the South. That's where they've been moving to overwhelmingly. And secondly, when you look at public opinion polls, what's the one section of the country in which a majority of blacks polled say they are treated fairly? It's right here. So it is not fair to keep talking about this, especially when we consider how were the political elites able to get away with imposing the various indignities that blacks suffered under. Particularly after World War II, when people began to notice this more than before. And basically the answer to this is that, like, for example, when we think about school segregation and how that came to an end, people think about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court handed down Brown versus Board of Education, and then the schools were desegregated. Well, that's not actually how it happened. And in fact, Michael Klarman, who's a professor at University of Virginia, he won the Bancroft Prize, which is awarded by Columbia University, for a book in which he showed that what actually happened was that the court made some statements, and then nothing happened. And then the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which extends voting rights to blacks, began to get some teeth in 1965. So after the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that's when the school desegregation occurs, because suddenly they realize, well, we have to listen to these people to some degree. So it was that. So this is apples and oranges, in other words, because now everybody's got the right to vote in the states, whereas they didn't at that time. So it's a lot easier to get away with these local oppressions. Now it's much harder. Today, when you look every single day, you see something coming out of Washington, D.C. that reaffirms you in your belief that there is just a fundamentally rotten regime in power, that no matter what person you vote for, it just doesn't matter. The surveillance gets worse, the wars get worse, the taxes get worse, everything gets worse no matter what you do. That is the locus of the threat that we face. And so, again, it's not to say that the states are without blemish. Again, of course, they're states. But might as well use them if we got them. And might as well, in Jefferson's mind, what we want to do is we want to pit ambition against ambition, pit power against power, to try to keep them in some kind of uneasy equilibrium. Get them fighting each other so that they're not fighting us quite as much. You know, hold them off. Create some kind of stability. We have at least some remote chance of influencing the local state legislator. Not that this is my sort of thing. I'm not really interested in that, but some people are. And you, like, this guy might actually live on your street. I mean, there's at least a 50-50 chance he's even a normal person. which you cannot say for basically like any federal official, right? I mean, like Ron Paul, you know, yeah, we all know the usual thing there. But so, I mean, like you have some possibility of reaching them. I mean, you could even win. I could run for state legislature and maybe even win. Is there any chance I'm getting elected U.S. president? That is not going to happen. But I could be sitting in the Alabama State House if I were a complete insane idiot who thought that was a good use of my time. But the point is that it could happen. It actually could happen. So there's at least some possibility that something could get done. Now, anytime though, oh, one other thing, competition among the states. Now, again, this is not real competition because the states are not firms. You know, I understand that. But the idea that Ralph Rako always talks about when he summarizes the scholarship on the European miracle, about how it is that in Western Europe we see sustained, long-run economic growth occurring. And one of the reasons for that is that after the fall of the Roman Empire, there was no continent-wide empire that took its place. You had a bunch of small principalities and so on. And because of that, if one of them becomes too oppressive, you just move 5 feet away and go to another one. And then the first one starts losing its tax base, and it says, whoa, wait a minute, if we exploit them that much, they're going to run away, so I got to exploit them less. It's in my interest to exploit them less. And then, of course, the tendency is to say, well, is for them to collude with each other, the rulers, and say, well, what if we had a big giant place they couldn't escape from? Then we could all get some loot. Okay, see, we don't want them to get to that point. Let's keep them super small, right? Super duper small. Let's have the Mises Institute be one of these places, right? Be a place of refuge for all of mankind in this old-time scenario. But that's what, according to many scholars, that's what made capitalism possible, was that the predatory nature of the state was crippled by the fact of sheer size. Whereas the U.S. government, there are certain economies of scale that are enjoyed. Like my old town of North Andover could not afford a nuclear missile, right? So we didn't have one, okay? But whereas the U.S. government, well, you can sort of fill in the blanks. All right, now on another matter, but related, when you talk about this sort of thing, people do not give you the benefit of the doubt. No, sir. They do not say, well, that's an interesting political philosophy you have. I'm glad you shared it. No, instead they say, what kind of sinister creep are you? What are you up to? What are you really, what's your real agenda? Like, what are you, I mean, because obviously anybody who advocates this is sitting up at night thinking, ooh, what can I use this for to oppress people? Ooh, and they got like the little flashlight under their chins just to make it all the more sinister. What can I use it for? So I knew that this sort of attack would come, that just assume that my motives are bad, that, you know, little harmless Tom Woods is actually part of a sinister plot to enslave America in some way by nullifying federal law. See, they never actually work at all. It doesn't really seem to work toward the end. So I enlisted the aid of a friend. You might know him. He's an economist in this room. It's Bob Murphy. And he and I did something with the help of our friend Chad here called Interview with a Zombie. Yeah, exactly, right. Now, if you haven't seen, Bob mentioned it earlier, if you haven't seen Interview with a Zombie, he's right. I did buy that domain name, and sure enough, it wasn't being used. Interviewwithazombie.com was 100% available. So I used that so that I can say it, you know, in the media easily, instead of saying, well, listen, go to YouTube and then type in, no, just interviewwithazombie.com. All right, and it redirects to my site. I got that trick from Gary North. He does that all the time. When he came here at the ASC and said, you know, we really have to go after Keynes, and I want you to go to my new site, KeynesProject.com. Oh, great. And it redirects to a page on GaryNorth.com. I mean, clever. Yeah. Well, hey, by the way, I bought the domain name LearnAustrianEconomics.com because nobody here was bright enough to think to take it from me. So I took it, and now it's like, so when everybody asks me, so what do I read? And I just say, I can't keep sending the same email. I just shoot them to that. Well, anyway, so Bob and I did this video, and some of you have seen it, but the idea was to show, you know, that I may actually have some things to say that are at least reasonable, but it's impossible to say them when the person interviewing you just keeps uttering, like, career-destroying words. And like, you, well, wait a minute, but see, everything I just said contradicts that career-destroying word. They just keep uttering it like you never said anything. So that's the idea. So we decided, Bob and I were talking about this, we were sitting at the RGS, the Rothbard Graduate Seminar, having lunch and with Lou and his wife sitting there with us. And I was saying, yeah, I want to do this video in which I'm talking to a zombie about nullification. And all he can do is just throw words at me. And meanwhile, I've got all the answers to this, and yet he won't listen and whatever. And it sort of will make a statement about the media and what it's like in this country. But I just can't think of anybody to cast as the zombie. And Bob's sitting there basically like, you know, hey, you know, I got zombie written all over me over here. What the heck are you talking about? So sure enough, I cast the guy as a zombie. I didn't even audition anybody else. It went right to Bob. We did it at my house in my old home office, and we even got Jeff Riggenbach to do the voiceover. Now, if you don't know Jeff Riggenbach, he reads, he has done actually a lot of sort of audiobook type reading, both for Mises Institute and for various companies. And so he's got one of these voices, he's been on radio quite a bit. He's got one of these beautiful voices, like the guy who died not too long ago, who used to do the movie previews. He's got a voice just like that. So I wrote to him and said, Jeff, I'm begging you, be so awesome if with your beautiful deadpan voice, introduced Interview with a Zombie, so it'll sound like it's a real show. I mean, this would be so great. And so sure enough, he says, yeah, sure, of course I'll do it. So again, you know, welcome to Interview with a Zombie. And I thought, oh, yeah. Oh, man, I can feel how good that is. That is so great. So I found out, thanks to Google, that he and his wife are what are self-described beer snobs. Like, they don't drink, like, regular brands of beer. They only get, like, super-duper, hard-to-find microbrew beers. So I got him a big gift basket full of hard-to-find microbrew beers, and he wrote to me and said, this is creepy. I don't know how you got me the best gift anyone has ever given. And he had forgotten that this was on his website. I'm like, well, you know, hey, I have a nose for these things. I just know. But anyway, so the whole video, it kind of works really well. It makes this point. And one of the things I point out is that when Bob, or as some people are calling him now, Rob Zombie, when he says slavery, and I say, well, actually, you know, nullification was never used to defend slavery, then I get a chance to talk about all the things that, or later on, things that it was used for. So it was introduced by Jefferson and Madison to stand up in favor of free speech, against restrictions on free speech, at a time when it was so bad that you notice there's a big gap in the correspondence between Jefferson and Madison at the critical time when they're drafting the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions that really codified nullification. There's a big gap because they don't dare to write to each other. They actually think their mail is being opened. Thomas Jefferson's the vice president at the time, and he can't safely write a letter. So there's that. There's the New England states that used it to fight against unconstitutional searches and seizures, against the embargo imposed by Jefferson, against the threat that military conscription could be undertaken. This is where Daniel Webster really redeems himself with his beautiful speech about the incompatibility of military conscription and liberty and the Constitution. But then the part of the speech that everybody leaves out is, well, what do we do if they do this to us? Well, then the states must interpose. The states have got to shield the people, stand in between the federal government and the people to prevent this outrage from being undertaken. We also see it carried out, of course, by South Carolina as the famous example with the tariffs. And, you know, that's arguable because the constitutional argument, it might have been a little shaky, arguably. South Carolina was arguing about the unconstitutionality of these particular tariffs. But the point is that some people will say, well, that was all really about slavery. Well, at the time, though, and this is really what matters, at the time, if you listen to what Northern protectionists and Northern free traders and Southern free traders, what they were all talking about tariffs and their economic consequences. Everybody, not a word about slavery. And also the president who was against South Carolina was a slaveholder. So there are no angels in this scenario. But the point is that by the end of the nullification attempt by South Carolina, the federal government decided to, in fact, lower the tariffs over the next 10 years. So whether or not you like South Carolina is immaterial. I mean, is there a libertarian who thinks it's bad that the tariffs were lowered? I mean, I'm glad this worked out. So it did, in fact, work. And yet you read in history textbooks, they say, well, this just goes to show nullification does not work. And I think, what? What are you talking about? What do you mean it shows it doesn't work? It did work. That's exactly how it's supposed to work. And then finally, there's the case of the fugitive slave laws, which although there is the fugitive slave clause in the Constitution, there were states that thought that as states, we have a responsibility to protect our citizens from potential kidnapping. And the way the Fugitive Slave Act, particularly of 1850, was being carried out was that a southern slave owner would go to a local judge and talk about, hey, my slave ran away, and he'd get kind of certificate that entitles him to the slave. So he could go into a northern state and say, here's a physical description of the slave who ran away, and hey, that guy kind of looks like him. I think I'm going to take him. And some states were saying, like particularly Wisconsin, well, now, you know, I think that's actually kind of open to abuse, don't you? That maybe somebody could just come up here and just start taking people. You know, so, no, we're going to give these people a jury trial. And they stood up to the U.S. Supreme Court. They stood up to everybody. This is the 1850s, 1859. You've got the legislature of Wisconsin quoting the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and 1799, extremely radical statements. So this can all be put to perfectly good and honorable purposes. Now, already the interview with a zombie is serving just the purpose that I had in mind for it. Because, oh no, a couple weeks ago, there's a guy, I don't want to mention his name, but he was sort of a very low-level official in the Reagan administration, and he's sort of spent his career, I mean, this is true, I'm not saying this just to put him down. It's just that as a matter of giving you his biography, it does in fact put him down, but that's just incidental to my purposes. But he spent his career jumping from one cause to the other, as one cause seemed to be better for his career. So, you know, first he was with Ron Paul, then that ship didn't seem to be sailing, so he went with the supply-siders, and then he decided to ditch that one and become a Keynesian, and then this past year he voted for Obama. So he just, you know, and each time it's always to just desperate for, see how super and great I am? Look, I mean, I betray everybody just to win new friends. And now the poor guy is in his late 50s, spending his time arguing with kids half his age on Facebook, and that's it. That's what he has to show for himself. So anyway, Randy Barnett, who's a professor, I'm going to get back to this guy in a second, but you'll see how Randy Barnett fits into this. Randy Barnett is a law professor I respect very much, and he and I disagree on this subject of nullification, but I don't think we really do. I think we're actually just talking past each other here. Because I would agree with him that, yeah, I know the Supreme Court isn't going to recognize this. I know that. I'm not an idiot. I do know that. The point is that if there is a critical mass of people behind the policy of not doing X, Y, or Z, the Supreme Court can issue all the statements it wants to, and people just aren't going to do it, as the medical marijuana case shows. So anyway, his name might have been Jim. That was a mistake. But anyway, so Randy Barnett wrote this article talking about nullification and talking about my position, but respectfully. And I wrote a respectful reply. Well, this guy on Facebook then posts a thing saying really terrible things about me. Again, uttering career-destroying sort of words. I seem to be sort of immune to this now, thankfully. But these sort of career-destroying accusations. And immediately, even among his own friends, everybody started saying, "Zombie! Zombie!" The guy did not know what hit him. Like, what? And he was posting the link to the video. Oh, this guy's a zombie. Yeah. Zombie, zombie, zombie. And now anytime somebody utters the word neo-Confederate, you just start laughing. Like this is such a stupid word. Like, nobody even uses this word to describe himself. My friend Scott Horton is the host of a really great radio program, anti-war radio, that's out of Austin, Texas, and out of L.A., and he's got a great, you can go to antiwar.com/radio, and he's interviewed like everybody under the sun. I mean, it's incredible. I don't know how he gets these guests. I actually said, what's your secret? How do you get such famous people on your show? He said, well, just call them up and say you've got a show called Anti-War Radio, and they sort of figure that it's probably 10 times as big as it is, because it's anti-war radio. This is the anti-war show? Of course I'll be on it. So it's awesome. I mean, you can listen to these. You could download the podcast. I mean, you learn so much because Scott knows so much, and he doesn't give himself enough credit. He knows so much. And he always tells me that as a libertarian, you have a responsibility. He reminds me of this all the time. He gives me pep talks sometimes. And he says, you know, Tom, you got a responsibility. You got to out-left the left, and you got to out-right the right, man. So tomorrow morning, I'll finish in just a couple minutes. Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. local time, I'm going on Wisconsin Public Radio for an hour to talk about nullification. Now, I've been on Wisconsin Public Radio before, and they didn't agree with me, but they were actually cordial. Like, people would actually call up and say, well, the source of my disagreement is so-and-so. Really? Like, well, so where are the smears? Like, I was expecting some terrible thing to be said, and they weren't. So this will be interesting, but I'm going to talk about the application of nullification to different sorts of issues tomorrow. And I'm going to mention that my friends at the 10th Amendment Center, which is a wonderful site, you think 10th Amendment Center, oh, that sounds so lame. Oh, we got to enforce the 10th Amendment, blah, 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 blah. No. These are serious nullifiers. We got to null, whatever's coming out, we're going to nullify it. So their new thing for 2010 and 11 is the Hemp Freedom Act. You know, look, the Founding Fathers grew this stuff. Come on. What the heck's the matter with you people? And then we wind up using hemp products. We got to import them. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. So we're going to have that. We're just going to nullify that. What are we going to do? We're going to throw growers in jail? Well, what am I saying? Of course they will. But if you've got a lot of people in one state doing it, you know, we'll see. They've got the Controlled Substances Nullification Act. And this is my sort of thing that I want to say to the left. You know, the left is, they're all against a war on drugs. And I'm not talking about the neocon New Republic left, that's just wrong on everything. I mean, like, the left sometimes, like, right on a few things, whereas the neocon left, you know, like the New Republic, it's like they go out of their way to say, how could we be wrong on every issue consistently? But some of the people on the left, they say this is an outrage. There are all kinds of violations of civil liberties that go on all the time. And you got minority kids getting shot in the back every 5 minutes. I mean, this is an intolerable injustice. So what am I going to do about it? I'm going to go give a speech. I'm going to hand out a leaflet. And then I'll wait until the year 2603 when we have enough people who are going to change this. And that's it. So my view is, no, I'm going to out-left the left here and say, are you kidding me? So an unbelievable outrage is going on right under your noses every day that you yourselves admit, and you're going to give a speech and that's it? Oh, I know. It's not going to be just any speech. You're going to pull out your bullhorn. Oh, come on. No. Here's what you do. You say, okay, the federal government's got these crazy laws that have resulted in all these terrible consequences, but in this city or in this state, we're not going to apply any resources to it. How do you like that? Well, that'd be interesting. How about at least trying it? Okay, and then if that doesn't work, you can get your bullhorn back out. You know, don't sell it. You know, at least try. You know, think. Think of something. Or think of some of these bogus terrorism cases where it turns out that it was some FBI goon who put the people up to it in the first place and whatever. I mean, over and over and over and over again, all around the country, outrages like this taking place all the time. And what's the left's thing? Oh, well, gee, let's just vote for better people next time. You got your better person. You got Barack Obama and the same thing goes on. No, why don't you have sheriffs who say, look, I've looked into this. I live three houses down from these guys and, you know, they're just fixing cars. Like, there is no bomb factory here. I can see it. You know, why don't you do that? Why don't you do something instead of your pamphlets and your speeches? So we'll see what they think about that. Now, I'm going to say that in a cordial way. I'm not going to say anything like I've said tonight, but just to indicate where I think we can go with this. There is finally a national tour being put on by my friends at the 10th Amendment Center called Nullify Now. And they're taking it to, they're starting in Fort Worth and then going to Orlando and Chattanooga and Phoenix and then to other cities just to force this issue into the political conversation. So I'm going to be participating in some of those. It's going to be super fun. But finally, given that I have at this point in a matter of a couple years, I've had a book on Austrian economics and I've had this book on nullification, I can say that it's true that the bad guys don't like either one. But the thing is, they don't understand Austrian economics that well because they're, not all of them, but some of the people who are against us, particularly the media people, just aren't that bright. So if you talk about the pure time preference theory of interest, nobody's saying, oh my gosh, all of society is being taken over by the free market people. They don't really quite get it. So this is sort of like an eccentricity that they'll allow us to have. But one thing they do understand, it seems to me, is disobey. The word disobey, because that could get out of control, and they cannot allow the peons to get out of control with the idea that they can disobey. So ultimately, what I'm hoping to do with this is to change a little bit some of the questions that are being asked. Because you know what they say, that if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about your answers. Well, thanks to the internet, we can ask questions even though the Washington Post isn't asking them, the New York Times isn't asking them, the New York Post isn't asking them, we can ask them anyway. We can get videos showing that Ben Bernanke has consistently been wrong for the past 5 or 10 years. We can clip these together. An average guy in his basement, you know, living with his mother, can put together a video like this that undermines in people's minds the legitimacy of the people who rule over us. So we have this possibility. We've got the intellectual infrastructure, thanks to the internet, to spread unapproved ideas. And man, it's super fun to do this, so let's all do it together. Thank you very much. This?